From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You've probably seen the headlines. Harvard geneticist George Church says we could clone a Neanderthal. Just need a mother chimp or an extremely adventurous female human to have the baby. Whatever happened to biology 101, photosynthesis, and amoeba? The arresting fact is biology has entered a whole new world, synthetic biology. The power, say its proponents, to reinvent nature, to biologically, synthetically produce fuel, medicine, housing, stronger humans, maybe even to raise the dead, the extinct. This hour on Point, houses from seeds, Neanderthals from cloning, geneticist George Church and synthetic biology. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the headlines? What do you think about the emerging power of synthetic biology? Where would you apply it? Where would you fear to go? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Earlier this week, the internet was on fire with newscaster headlines about how a Harvard scientist had said that an extremely adventurous female human could one day potentially give birth to a Neanderthal.
Like a missed connection burped from the depths of hell's Craigslist page, Harvard geneticist George.
The adventurous female to give birth to a cloned Neanderthal.
Sir Church believes, Sam, cloning the species, believed to be our ancestors, 33 million years after they became extinct, could help provide answers to diseases such as cancer, HIV.
The cells would then be injected into a human embryo. Then he says all he needs is a volunteer.
It's just plain creepy, the idea that, you know, there's a couple of empty wombs lying around, and let's fill them up, you know, with a Neanderthal. I mean, what will they think of?
Neanderthal. I don't know. Jane, I saw Rosemary's Baby all those years ago, and I'm damaged as a result.
Oh, boy. What's really going on here? Let's find out. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and the founder of the Personal Genome Project there. He also leads the Synthetic Biology Platform, part of the Harvard's Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering, which he helped found. He's also founded over a dozen companies. His new book has made headlines. It's called Regenesis, co-authored with Ed Regis. Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. Dr. Church, it's great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
So this is interesting. I mean, I sat down after all the headlines flew by and just began to read into your book. And indeed, you're talking about Regenesis is the title of your book. There's so much going on with synthetic biology, and I want to talk about the whole waterfront because it is really interesting. But let's just go for a moment to this issue that's grabbed so many headlines this week. You are talking about bringing species back from extinction, that capacity.
Bringing back at least pieces of DNA that we have sequenced or that others have sequenced from museum samples is a technical possibility.
I'm reading from your wonderful prologue here. It says, a technique under development in my Harvard lab will allow us to resurrect practically any extinct animal whose genome is known or can be resurrected from fossil remains, up to and including the woolly mammoth, the passenger pigeon, and even Neanderthal man. How is that or would that be done?
So what would be done would depend upon societal initiatives for there would have to be benefits would outweigh the risks. And technically, it would the breakthrough that we're talking about that enables this and many other health benefits is to precisely engineer pieces of DNA within an animal genome. Using new methods called zinc finger nucleases or TALENs or CRISPR. And in addition to our ability to make DNA much more cost-effectively using DNA chips.
How far back can you reach into time, find genetic material, and use it to, as you write, resurrect practically any extinct animal?
So you can read DNA, and this is not work from my lab, but from many other talented researchers. You can read DNA from museum specimens and specimens in the wild out to about 500,000 years. At that point, the DNA is so it's quite degraded almost instantly, but out to that point, it gets hard to very hard to read.
So Neanderthal, well within that, they're back 200,000 years or so.
There's some samples as recently as 30,000, yeah.
And, of course, we carry Neanderthal DNA within ourselves. I think I've read you saying you yourself have 3% Neanderthal DNA. It's not like it's only in the past.
That's correct. Full disclosure. 3%.
Right. And you know that because you had your own genome sequence, presumably.
That's right. Everyone should.
Everyone should. We'll talk about that. You write, the genome sequences of both the woolly mammoth and Neanderthal man have been substantially reconstructed. The genetic information that defines those animals is known and is stored in computer databases. So if you wanted to bring back a woolly mammoth or Neanderthal, what do you do with that exactly?
Right. So you need to take an existing specimen, so say an elephant in the case of a woolly mammoth, and you're trying to introduce at least some parts of its genome, not necessarily every bit of it, the parts that would confer, say, fat and wool so that it could survive in the Siberian or Canadian tundra. And you would enter, you would synthesize them from the computer.
Let me just see who them. You'd build this on an extant elephant's DNA.
Stem cell. So in the stem cell is DNA.
And you'd introduce to that the woolly mammoth DNA, and
exactly.
It would be a blend.
That's correct. And in principle, you could make it closer and closer to whatever's in the computer, or you can be selective and just introduce particular traits that you think would help the existing species to survive in changing environments that we have today.
Do you think you could come up with, over time, an actual full-on woolly elephant mammoth, even a woolly mammoth that matched the DNA of the original?
I think it's an interesting open question. I mean, there don't seem to be huge limitations to what we can synthesize chemically and then what we can introduce into mammalian genomes like the elephant.
Or human. You say, you write again in the prologue from your book Regenesis, you write, if society becomes comfortable with cloning, and that's a big if, but nevertheless, and sees value in true human diversity, of which you're a big champion, then the whole Neanderthal creature could itself be cloned by a surrogate mother chimp or by an extremely adventurous female human, reading from your prologue in Regenesis. So what do? You take, you've got the stem cell, you've got this old DNA, you introduce the old DNA into the stem cell, and then how does that become a fertilized egg in the womb of a chimp or a woman?
Yeah, so it's old DNA that's been in the computer and then resynthesized in a new form, and then integrated precisely into a stem cell genome, and then those can be introduced. It's been shown in mm-hmm. mice and some other species that you can go from laboratory cells into embryos and get a full organism out of it.
So whether it was a chimp or the adventurous woman you describe here, it wouldn't really be their DNA. It would all be introduced. They'd simply be gestating this.
That's correct. So there are 14 mammals that have been cloned. Basically, you take
Dolly and right on down.
Right, exactly. And so in agricultural circles, this is not considered exceptional. Mm-hmm. I think for humans, this would be quite exceptional and only undertaken if the benefits to society and to the individuals outweigh the risks.
I've read you saying, though, that you could well imagine it technically possible well within 50 years, within the lifetimes of people alive right now.
50 years is not that long a time anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
We thought that a cost-effective and affordable human genome was 50 years away
mm-hmm.
just 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so things are accelerating. And so part of the reason that I like to bring up these ethical issues mm-hmm. is that technology is arriving much faster
so
than we thought it would.
So heads up, everybody.
Exactly.
What possibly could be the benefit, whether it's a woolly mammoth or let's take Neanderthal, what could the benefit be to humans or to the planet of reintroducing the Neanderthal people, if that's the right word, Neanderthals?
Well, I think this is something that requires a broad discussion. I think the argument has probably been made publicly by others, like Zimov, for the mammoth is a much clearer case where the tundra used to be a much more vibrant ecosystem with grasslands and many abundant mammalians and other bird species. And the mammoths really were required for pounding down the snow and eating the waste grass. So that's an example.
On the woolly mammoth side. But on Neanderthal, I have read you writing and saying we may need the diversity Neanderthals represent to meet the challenges we're in part creating for ourselves on this planet. Why?
Yeah. Well, and it's I think the interesting thing about raising diversity is not necessarily this particular one, but are we neglecting some of the diversity we currently have? As you know, if we worry about bringing something into the world that has some new kind of diversity, are we also
new synthetic products? Or entities.
Yeah. Or bringing back somebody that wasn't. Are we also paying attention to the diversity we have here already?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about synthetic biology, creating new life and bringing back maybe old life, extinct life, even Neanderthal man. It's been the subject of fiction for a long time. Jurassic Park theme behind us right there. There's a lot going on in the labs right now. My guest today is Dr. George Church. He writes in his new book, Regenesis, a technique under development in my Harvard lab will allow us to resurrect practically any extinct animal, up to and including the woolly mammoth, the passenger pigeon, and even Neanderthal man. There's much more coming with synthetic biology as well. We're talking about it this hour. We're going to expand our circle of guests in a moment, bring in an ethicist, another synthetic biologist as well. But let's hear from our listeners a little bit first. Thomas is calling from Bloomington, Illinois. Great to see that. Thomas, thanks for calling. You're on the air with George Church.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is concerned with the application of this genetic technology to the human genome, and it's inspired by Bill McKibben's book, Enough, which I'll bet you've read because I know you're a fan of his. However,
yes, I have.
You know, it's talk about bringing Neanderthals back. Neanderthals went extinct for a reason, and we may be producing them, but in not quite the way that we think.
What do you mean?
You know, if genetic engineering comes to the point, and I don't see how it could not come at least to our ability to do it, where we can start to tinker with humans, right, make them better, faster, smarter, what have you. It's clear that, my guess is that this will not be covered by health insurance, and, you know, people who have the means will be able to, you know, engineer their children to be, you know, better than others. And, and you know, if you follow this into the future, what you'll have is sort of a bifurcation of the race. And there'll be some people that are designed to be better and some people that are not. Neanderthals went extinct for a reason, and the reason was probably us. But we're going to recreate that situation if we allow biotechnology to sort of improve some portion of us, but not all of us.
Thomas, let us pick it up. George Church, you say, look, this the capacity to do this is here, and it's developing rapidly when it comes to humans. There are limits that are on cloning and more right now, but you clearly foresee this possibility of having stronger, smarter Homo sapien. And obviously that would, I suppose, be available to those with means earlier than others. On the other hand, you and others say, look around the world. We've got all kinds of vaccines that weren't even out in the hands of the poor until Bill Gates began to pay for them. So this is just the way it works when you come to advances in science very often.
Well, I think there are a lot of ideas to unpack in this part of the conversation. One of the things that's happened is that the costs are plummeting. They've come down a millionfold in the last 9 years. This is unprecedented in other fields.
So the cost of sequencing?
Of sequencing and DNA. Synthetic approaches to vaccines and gene therapies.
Mm-hmm.
So many diagnostics and therapeutics are coming down to the price where they could be global, not necessarily just in the hands of the rich. Many rare diseases are reimbursed now, their therapies. And we see things like cell phones, 7 billion cell phones around the world. Technology can diffuse quite quickly. So that's one part of this.
To stick with that for a moment, to Thomas's question, and I mean, you've described how synthetic biology could indeed enhance the strength of humans, enhance the intellect potentially of humans. What are you foreseeing then? A time when perhaps people with more means would have more access to that, but over time and not too much time, that would be diffused among the whole human race?
I think that it's already happening, essentially. It's not a prediction. We have phase two approved clinical trials for precise gene targeting that makes people that have active HIV/AIDS immune to it by changing their human cells so that they're missing both copies of the CCR5
mm-hmm.
receptor for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
This, as far as I know, is not being applied to wealthy people. This is being applied to regular folks that are involved in the phase two clinical trials. Mm-hmm. It's not available to everybody yet because it has to be safety tested, like everything. One of the main themes of the Regenesis book
mm-hmm.
is safety.
Yes.
How do we do it? How do we engineer safety the way we do in cars and,
mm-hmm.
and so forth?
No, I read that loud and clear, but it's interesting. At the same time, there's a sort of a flexible envelope around that. You describe safety or what's seen as acceptable as fluid. I mean, it has changed over time. When new things get introduced, they're seen as abhorrent, and then you come back in 10 years or 20 years and everybody's doing it.
Absolutely.
So I read you as seeing some kind of fluidity here as well, that the science will make things possible and then acceptable that may be challenging to our minds now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's largely a matter of risk and benefit. Surgery had a very high risk before we figured out infectious disease.
Mm-hmm.
It had a potential benefit that was never seen because people were dying. We've completely changed our attitude to surgery, so we now do elective surgery, where you get
sure.
cosmetic surgery, where there's
right.
really nothing wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I approve of that. I'm just saying
the risk is low enough that we just do it.
And so I think it's a little bit arrogant or lacking in humility if we say for sure something will remain icky or undesirable mm-hmm. forever. A lot of people are, not me, but a lot of people mm-hmm. are right now in favor of some of the things that have been going through the news right now.
Such as, you mean?
Well, do people volunteer to be surrogates for a Neanderthal child? Okay, that shows that there is, if it's safe, and maybe mm-hmm. if there is some risk. There are
right.
a lot of things that we do that involve
mm-hmm.
risk. There's enthusiasm. So I don't feel so confident
right.
that I know what the right answer is. I think the
mm-hmm.
discussion is the important thing, and to do it early before it's too late.
Have surrogates stepped forward to say, hey, I would carry a Neanderthal?
Hundreds of people have shown enthusiasm. That doesn't mean that we should do it.
Hundreds of women have said, if you want to do it, here I am.
Absolutely.
Robert's calling from Irmo, South Carolina. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah.
Tom, my question is this. After a clone Neanderthal is born, whether it be to a chimpanzee or to a surrogate human mother,
mm-hmm.
what happens to the Neanderthal itself? Do they put it in a cage and just raise it like an animal? I'm not against this by any means if it'll help mankind, but what happens to the animal itself? Pardon me for calling it an animal, but how do they treat this thing? Do they put it in an experimental?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, we're all animals, so I guess it's not an insult. George Church, what do you say to Robert's question?
Well, again, this would not be up to me. This would be up to all sorts of ethicists and safety boards and so forth. But almost certainly the humane thing to do would be to treat these individuals as people, get them decent educations, have a cohort where –
Not just one, but a
– But a large number
community.
Of them.
Mm-hmm.
And try to not treat them as objects of curiosity, but as you know, as we would many indigenous tribes, or but in this case, they would probably be educated in a modern world.
Well, what do we know? I mean, again, you're right. The genetic information that defines these animals exists, is known, and stored in computer databases. What do you know about Neanderthals? Their physical strength, their intellectual strength. What's known? They had a larger head.
They had a larger brain size. That doesn't necessarily have any implication for the type of intellect that they would have.
Would we find out by actually cloning or creating one, and then we would begin to know? Is that the idea?
If society decided to go down that route, that would be one of the things that would be discovered.
Could they? Yeah. Could it turn out that they're more intellectually gifted than Homo sapien?
All of these things are broad distributions,
but there's a mean,
and there could be a mean that could be higher. Just because they went extinct doesn't necessarily imply anything about intellect.
And you talk about risk and benefit. Could you clarify what would the potential benefit be of this?
It's very hard to anticipate what the benefits are of the Apollo moonshot, for example. We didn't necessarily precisely describe GPS navigation in the streets, for example, and I think the same thing here.
But you have thought about it a lot.
Part of the reason for bringing this up is to get other people to think about risks and benefits. And some of the benefits might be that we are limited, that we are very chauvinistic in the way we think about things, that we...
As humans, chauvinistic as Homo sapien. We're tops. We're number one.
Sometimes we want to have alien intelligences to discuss things with, and sometimes we don't. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an open question. It depends on safety and to the individuals.
What about our caller Thomas's observation or assertion that Neanderthals went extinct for a reason? And they're, so don't mess with that.
I'm sure there were reasons in terms of cause and effect. It could be that we were more aggressive than they were, rather than the other way around. It could be that they were too adapted for a cold environment or didn't travel as much.
So it wasn't necessarily an innate superiority somehow, whatever that means, of Homo sapiens.
I think that would be extremely arrogant to consider any particular type of person to be more superior to another innately.
A person widely defined there. Mary in Sudbury, Massachusetts. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Hi. Dr. Church.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yes, you're on.
Hello. Well, I'm calling because the whole topic and the subject brought back to mind a film I saw about 20 years ago starring Charles Dance. It was called Firstborn, where he's the geneticist who donates, he becomes the father donor and to a mother gorilla, and they create a child. It's supposed to be a government program that invests in science. And the whole film unfolds over several episodes.
What's the moral of the story, Mary? What'd you take away from it?
It's complex, for one thing. Society is involved. The people involved with the raising of the child are emotionally invested. It's hard to make choices about what to do about the child after the child succeeds so well in society. The outcome, I don't want to tell you the outcome. I think you should watch the film. It's marvelous.
Mary, let me ask you, Dr. Church, writes about a surrogate mother chimp or an extremely adventurous female human who might volunteer to be the surrogate mother of a Neanderthal, and says that many have expressed interest in that already. Could you imagine playing that role, Mary?
No, not me. I'm in my 60s. But the woman in the film becomes very emotionally invested in this child, and then the government decides to end the program, and they part. And the emotional trauma of that is hard to watch. But then the father, the donor, the only person who really knows the outcome of this young man's career in life and is invested. That, too, is interesting to watch.
Mary, we've got it. The Firstborn. Look back if you're interested, listeners, and thanks for that, Mary. Emotion around all relationships and emotion around this science itself has been interesting to watch George Church sort of come out into the public arena with his thoughts as outlined in the new book, Regenesis, how synthetic biology will reinvent nature and ourselves. He joins me in the studio with us as well right now from Berkeley, California, is Jay Kiesling. He's director of the Synthetic Biology Engineering Research Center, SINBERC, professor of biochemical engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. Jay Kiesling, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
Synthetic biology gets paraded in many different ways. This week, it's got a little Neanderthal tint to it, but there are all kinds of anticipated outcomes and products of this research. Give us a sense of the range, Jay.
That's right, Tom. There's some really practical things that are being done right now. I just got back from Africa, where a drug that we've developed is being launched to cure malaria. This is a drug that would normally come from a plant. Because it comes from a plant, it's hard to get access to. It's expensive for people who are dying of malaria and live on less than a dollar per day. So we engineered a yeast to consume sugar, spit out this drug, and we can stabilize the supply and produce it at a lower cost than you can from the plant. And this is being launched this year. And so we think this will save potentially 1 million children a year. Wow. And could lower the cost for people who live with malaria but suffer from it. There's also a lot of work being done on engineering microbes to produce advanced fuels that could reduce the production of greenhouse gases and help us to have homegrown energy.
So there's all kinds of fronts here. You, George Church, and others working on. Roll us forward. I mean, we're talking about making human organs, even using biology to do construction, synthetic biology to do construction. Explain that. Plant a seed and a house pops up? Or what does that mean, Jay?
You know, so I think in the shorter term, we could engineer trees to be better wood for building houses. There's some thought that you could, in fact, engineer the genetic code inside a tree. So you could plant a seed in the ground, and it would grow into a house, a tree house of some sorts, so you wouldn't have to construct it at all. The tree would do all the construction for you. I think that's a bit far out, but it's, you know, something we can't dismiss. But again, in the short term, we'll be able to make better materials using synthetic biology and solve a lot of human problems.
And what about regenesis? George Church and others are thinking about it, writing about it. What do you think about it? De-extinction, regenesis.
You know, I think it's a really interesting possibility. And I was listening to a conversation earlier, and you know, I think it has a lot of benefits. It's also something, though, that we have to consider as a society. Is it something that we want to do? There could be some real benefits in bringing back life forms that have gone extinct, particularly those that have gone extinct due to human activity.
Like what, beyond bringing, you know, a healthier tundra back? Like what?
Well, maybe we want the dodo bird, for instance.
For what?
To come back so that we can study it, so that we could put it back in its natural habitat and reclaim that habitat. I think there's all huge number of reasons for doing it. There are also a lot of reasons for not doing it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about synthetic biology, creating new life, new forms, and bringing back maybe old life, extinct life, even Neanderthal man. George Church is with us. He's professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, co-author of Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. Regenesis as in, yes, perhaps some de-extinction, also as in regenerative medicine, and lots of potential there. Joins me in the studio. With us from Berkeley, California, is Jay Kiesling, director of the Synthetic Biology Engineering Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, professor of biochemical engineering. You can join us as well. Have you kept up with the promise, the possibilities of all this? And what's your question for our synthetic biologists? Lots of response online. Drew in Georgia, George J. says, the nerd in me says, go man, go. The realist says, whoa, man, whoa, tread carefully. Gretchen writes to us. She says, I'm alive and healthy today because of synthetic biology and the amazing advances this type of engineering has had on synthetic insulin. For Gretchen, who has diabetes, Toyota wants to know when regeneration of organs like kidneys, eyes, and livers will be available. And Elle, responding to this talk of an extremely adventurous female human to gestate a Neanderthal, says this is as close to misogynism as I've ever heard on Point. Use the word adventurous as a euphemism for treating a woman like a 98-degree Ziploc bag one more time, and I'll really let you have it. Elle, consider us having had it here. Big range of responses from saved me to excitement and woe to, wait a minute, don't talk about using a woman quite that way. With us now from New York City is Arthur Kaplan, a professor of bioethics at New York University. Arthur Kaplan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Jay. Hi, George.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Synthetic biology getting kind of a workout this week, Arthur Kaplan. There's all kinds of developments embedded here. George Church says, heads up, everybody. This is happening. And how far it goes and what we do with it will depend in very large part on what humans think about it, how they feel about it, their judgments about it. Is the ethics community focused on these advances in synthetic biology, Art?
Well, not as much as they should be. The good news for the ethics community is synthetic biology promises to be the full employment act for bioethicists.
Yeah, no kidding.
A lot of labor to come in thinking through these issues. Unfortunately, I don't think we've had enough attention to this particular exciting, important area of technological innovation. A little bit of separation of the bioethicists from some of the mainstream basic science workers like Jay and George, bioethics in particular focusing more on the clinic. So that gap needs to be closed.
And a lot of this, you've said, going on in secret, Defense Department, military, you know, stuff that's not even – it's behind closed doors if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, I can come out of the closet and say I've had some opportunity to discuss synthetic biology with the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration, which is part of the Defense Department, trying to think about the use of synthetic biology in biological warfare for other security purposes, if you will. So there are some sort of gray areas and disturbing areas where, you know, bad guys can use synthetic biology too, so to speak.
Let's look forward and let's look back a little bit. Back first. Whether it was a woolly mammoth or a Neanderthal, as a bioethicist, how do you begin to think about the ethical issues there?
I have this image of George building his Regenesis Noah's Ark, loading up the species.
Dodo birds and woolly mammoths coming off the Ark.
Two of a kind everywhere. Yeah. But, you know, the way I think about it is the sort of lower down the evolutionary or phylogenetic scale you get in terms of our worries about risk versus benefit, the better. The yeasts and the microbes that Jay was talking about, basically, you can harm them, kill them by the zillions, and nobody cares. But when you get toward Neanderthals or even engineering humans for that matter, the risk factor relative to the benefit, you really have to show the benefit in a bigger way, a much more significant way. So, you know, one error in that genome for the Neanderthal could make a dead Neanderthal. Mm-hmm. One miscommunication between Neanderthal DNA and the human cytoplasm in an egg could be trouble. And we've seen that trouble in cloning in some species. Dolly herself had many, many health problems.
The
died.
Sheep that was brought back.
Yeah, and a lot of deformed stillborn animals have been produced by cloning. You might accept that perhaps in some species.
I mean,
we do.
People don't like it many, but we do experiments on live creatures all the time.
Yes. But if you get closer to – when we're talking Neanderthals, I think it would be – very difficult unless you had a huge benefit to sort of venture the risk. Similarly, if you make a Neanderthal, and we've talked about this a bit, we're not really sure what its environment was, what to feed it, what would make it flourish, or what would make a colony of Neanderthals. We can guess do well or flourish, but there's a risk, if you will, to their well-being and what they are in terms of our ignorance, not just about their genes, but about their environment.
And would it even be a Neanderthal exactly without that environment, without everything else around it? I mean, I think you were talking with one of my producers, said, look, get the Shroud of Turin. You could talk about cloning Jesus, but you wouldn't have the Roman Empire. You wouldn't have Bethlehem. You wouldn't have the context.
I was asked once by a group that said they wanted to fund a project to clone Jesus by getting DNA off the Shroud of Turin. Now, presuming those assumptions were true about the Shroud of Turin, would you create Jesus again, put aside the fact he's supposed to come back, but would you have him back if you didn't have the Roman Empire, if you didn't have Bethlehem, if you didn't have the temple, if you didn't have all the his parents, all the historical facts, environmental facts that made him who he was can't be recreated. And in that sense, you wind up having sort of an object of curiosity, a kind of tweener creation, but not the authentic thing that you had from the past due to the limits on recreating not the genes, but the developmental and environmental situation. So again, not saying never, 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 but you really have to come over a hurdle of benefit, I think, to justify the experiment. One other little point here. If you make a Neanderthal from 30,000 years or older, remember what happened when the Europeans met the Native Americans in the Caribbean and in North America. They killed them all through smallpox. Do we know what bugs or circulating flu viruses or forms of airborne disease would be, you know, able to be handled by a Neanderthal genome from 30,000 years ago? I don't, but I'd worry.
But of course, here's where you get into many potentialities in synthetic biology. George Church, you've talked about being able to create humans who were immune to viral infection.
Right. The one example we mentioned earlier was already in phase 2 clinical trials making humans immune to HIV by changing their cells, their genomes in adults.
But you're talking about a multivirus immunity or a pan immunity.
We know quite a bit about a variety of immunities, and the one that you're referring to that's highlighted in the book is changing the genetic code. This is a true application of genome-wide engineering rather than just engineering a few genes. And we're applying it to organisms of industrial significance, such as the ones that Jay and I work on, that are subject to serious viral infections during production runs, such as one that messed up the cells in
the flu vaccine
in Genzyme here in Boston, shut down for a year, wiping out all kinds of production capabilities. So these have early applications that are potentially quite practical.
Jay Kiesling, I mean, there's so much possibility here. It sort of boggles the mind, but you can imagine a kind of arms race going on where you're racing to create humans who are immune to viral infection. At the same time, somebody is working on bringing a Neanderthal who may carry something that doesn't even fit our understanding of virus as we know it now, Jay. I mean, can we, once we begin this field of development, can we keep up with its myriad possibilities of expression?
Well, you know, I think it's really complicated, and I think there's a lot we have to think about it. But, you know, consider the fact that genetic engineering came into practice in the early 70s, and we've been getting better and better at doing genetic engineering to the point now where it's more predictable, it is easier to do, so it costs less to do it. So, you know, this is not something that just happened overnight or last week. It's something that's been coming for the last few decades. But, you know, as you said, it's really complicated. There's a lot for us to consider. And the better we get at it, the larger the system we have to take into consideration.
But I mean, historically, this all seemed so vast that many people said, well, you know, God takes care of that, or evolution, something that happens over millions of years. When you start to bring it into human time and human hands, are you concerned? I mean, there's great potential, and at the same time, you know, maybe more than we can keep a handle on.
Well, I don't think it's more than we can keep a handle on. We just have to make the commitment politically, legislatively, and on an international basis to really take it seriously and start to set up groups and bodies that can sort of guide where we want to go. You know, the notion is somehow that the science runs ahead of the ethics and the ethics can never catch up with this. Well, it's still relatively early days. There is time, in a sense, to have the conversations that George has triggered with his book and that Jay's points about microbial engineering are raising. So I think we still can sort of keep the, if you will, the ethics in tandem, in sync with where the science is. But we've got to get moving now. Can't wait.
Let's go to Valerie, who's calling us. She's on the road on the Alabama-Tennessee border. Valerie, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. And I'm calling. I'm on I-65 South traveling.
Great.
And I am love listening to National Public Radio and the different programs for increased knowledge and education. And I'm curious about this topic of regenesis. Since I'm also a physician, I'm an obstetrician gynecologist.
Yes.
And my first question or my first thought is, I know that research requires funding. How is Dr. Church being funded in this research? Who's doing the funding and who are the grantors for this this project of regenesis that he's working with?
Let us pick it up, Valerie. Thank you. George Church?
I just want to be clear that we are not working on Neanderthal either reading or writing its genome, and we're not cloning any animal or human. We are funded by many different government agencies, including NSF and NIH and Department of Energy, for technology development for some of the sort of things that Jay and I have been talking about that are of societal benefit.
So when you write about in your book that technique under development in my Harvard lab will allow us to resurrect practically any extinct animal up to and including Neanderthal man, who's funding that technique, that research?
So the technique can be applied to gene therapy in humans.
Mm-hmm.
It can be also be applied to other things that we need to talk about that we are not being funded for. And that's being funded by all the agencies that I just listed.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every government agency wants to see some progress in bringing down the costs of reading and writing DNA for medical reasons.
Jay Kiesling, George Church describes, you know, how we thought certain things would take 50 years when it came to reading the genome, and then boom, they were done before you knew it. I mean, how much can people listening and alive today look forward to synthetic biology in their lifetimes, changing medicine, changing fuel production, changing food production, changing even construction? How much of this is imminent in the terms of, let's say, within a human life, Jay?
Oh, we're seeing a lot of it be implemented today. And as George said, you know, it's very difficult to imagine all the things that we're going to be able to do with this, and it's going to move very quickly.
Tell us more.
Well, I mean, look, as George said, we thought it'd take us 50 years to have the personal genome, and we're seeing it took 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Creating fuels, it's going to take a long time to implement those, but the companies are creating the organisms now. They've got fuels coming out. They're actually in cars and buses and planes. So we can look forward to a lot of these things, replacing a lot of the chemicals we use now and that we get from petroleum with chemicals from sugars. These are all things that are happening right now. And in the near future, I think it's going to be very practical if you have an organ failure, to be able to take a piece of DNA or clone your cell line directly and build an organ.
That's a lot. The questions just keep coming. Jerry in Evansville says to us, you have a Neanderthal, you can have him with a driver's license, you can let him vote, you're going to draft him, let him buy an assault weapon. What church would he go to? I mean, I wonder, Jay, when do you, there's one example, but there are so many. When do we get, or are we there already, to the big ethical issues that we need to have a society-wide kind of consensus on? Are we there now?
Well, we already heard this today that, time is now to begin discussing these things. And bioethicists have been involved with synthetic synthetic biologists discussing these possibilities, but we need to do more of this as a society. You know, the point, though, is that there's so much that can be done to help humans right now that we want to do this in a smart way. We want to be talking about the future and how to think about this science, potentially regulate the science. At the same time, we want to make sure that the science goes forward because it's going to solve a lot of really big problems.
Art Kaplan, you're our ethicist here. Are you, on balance, are you heartened by this? Are you more worried by this? You know, is this going to save us or get us in deeper doo-doo?
I think I'm heartened. I think, believe it or not, despite my worries about the sort of hypothetical Neanderthal project, I think that these technologies in terms of fuel, health and disease, manufacturing processes, all to the good, but we need to have a bigger ethical infrastructure in place to use them wisely.
Well, here's one more beginning of that conversation today, and we're very grateful for it. Our eyes opened, our horizons expanded, and a little more clarity around what we're reading in the headlines, and we're grateful for that. Arthur Kaplan at NYU's Division of Medical Ethics. Thanks very much for joining us today, Art.
Thank you.
Jay Kiesling at SINBERG at Berkeley in California. Jay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and co-author of Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. Dr. Church, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.